Hello, welcome to Focus on Community. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and we are live on the air tonight for this month's edition of a radio program dedicated to informing Southeast Alaska K2 listeners about a myriad of psychological and social issues confronting us in our daily lives, and ultimately about living our lives with more awareness and greater happiness. Tonight's topic is one that I have wanted to explore for quite some time, especially with our guest tonight, Pat White. It's about developing the skills to live our lives mindfully. Now, we read articles and advertisements all the time about products we can buy or medications we can ingest to make us calmer and happier and maybe even healthier. And supposedly, all it takes is a prescription or a shopping trip to Costco to possess something that will reduce our stress and improve our immune system. Or will it? The Beatles sang, "Money can't buy me love." Well, tonight, we'll look at the proposition that it's our way of thinking and judging that affects our contentment and happiness, not what we buy. Perhaps trying to find happiness by grasping at things outside of ourselves is an illusion. So money can't buy us love, that's for sure. But maybe money alone can't buy us peace of mind either. So tonight, I'll have a conversation with Pat White, a longtime counselor in Juneau, about mindfulness practices that have become recognized as an effective psychotherapeutic intervention for people with high levels of stress, chronic pain, depression and anxiety, etc. But first, let me tell our listeners how to contact us during this show, because we're live. And we encourage you to call in with any questions or comments. Our number in Juneau is 463-6425, or outside now, I don't think the new 800 number works for call-in. Does it, John? Do you know if it works? The 800 number, can you call in on that? We don't know. Better stick with 907-463-6425. We have new phones in the studio, and we're just figuring out how to use them. But we'll get you on the air without identifying you by name. You can also call the same number, 463-6425, and have our operator write down your question, which I will then read on the air, and you have total anonymity. So, don't be shy. Contact us during the show, and either I or Pat will respond to your question or comment. Now, I'd like to introduce my guest this evening, Pat White, who's been a counselor in private practice in Juneau for at least as long as I have, at least, maybe longer. Welcome, Pat.
Welcome. Thank you, Elaine.
How long have you been in private practice in Juneau?
About 25 years.
I'm longer than you. Okay, by 3 years. Mm-hmm. I moved here 28 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew you and I were about the same vintage, shall we say, the same era. What happened that you began to incorporate mindfulness practices in your counseling work?
Well, I was very interested in the body's reaction to stress and studied and took some biofeedback training. And everywhere in the literature and in my training, they talked about breathing as a way to calm the body. And breathing became very interesting to me. So breathing and mindfulness go hand in hand, as you know. So mm-hmm. It started with that. And people talked about meditation and mindfulness training, and so I decided that I really ought to experience it myself before I incorporate that into my practice. So I started meditating, if you will, or mindfulness practice, about 20 years ago, and used it for myself for a year to make sure that I understood it and was willing to talk about it with other people. So about a year after that, I started using it for people who had anxiety, mostly panic attacks and stress-related illnesses, hypertension, headaches, that sort of thing.
Well, you were an early adopter because I also have meditated for a long time. I have a long history of meditation practice, but I feel it wasn't until maybe 15 years ago that mindfulness, and we'll explain a little later the what mindfulness, what meditation is and all that, but that mindfulness became, or mindfulness practices became a really accepted, I'd almost say hot aspect mm-hmm. in our training.
That's right.
Nowadays, you go to any conference. Pat and I just received an invitation for a conference in Anchorage mm-hmm. that is completely on, for therapists, for psychotherapists, mm-hmm. is completely on mindfulness
so practices. Before mindfulness became the buzzword, if you will, stress reduction was yeah. what everybody was talking about, and that's how I entered it.
Yeah,
with stress reduction.
And so you've been doing it for a long time, as have I have too. What would you think is a good definition so folks can know what we're talking about, mindfulness?
Well, mindfulness is the result of training your mind
yeah.
To calm the mind, if you will, but mostly to understand the mind. To understand the way your thinking patterns are, if you will. So mindfulness allows you to become objective, have a sort of a mastermind, as I call it, a mind that can think about what you're thinking about.
Mm-hmm. To think about, be aware of your thoughts.
Right.
I think a very common definition is non-judgmental awareness of mm-hmm. the present moment. You said the other day something interesting. Difference between in the moment and for the moment.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, I, the for the moment idea is what our culture may promote. Let's have fun today and let's just decide for this very moment what we want to do and how we want to do it. But being in the moment is more about awareness, and it's less about experiencing something, really. It's more about an objective, non-judgmental experience in the world.
And here's a definition that may be pretty encompassing. And it would be, mindfulness refers to being completely in touch with and aware of the present moment, as well as taking a non-evaluative or non-judgmental approach to your inner experience. For example, a mindful approach to one's inner experience is simply viewing thoughts as thoughts instead of evaluating certain thoughts as positive or negative. So you're looking at your thoughts. And I've trained with Jon Kabat-Zinn, who developed mindfulness-based stress reduction, and I've taught mindfulness-based stress reduction classes in Juneau. And here's how he defines it. Mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally.
Non-judgmental is a really interesting idea. Well, what does that really mean? To me, it means that we are allowing ourselves to experience things without wanting them to go away or wanting them to stay. That we have an ability to let go of whatever comes into our mind and not evaluate it, non-judgmental, and to let it float through, if you will, and let all the thoughts float through so that maybe in between the thoughts there is the mindfulness, the experience of the moment.
Yeah. It's such a useful, I'm so happy that I have trained in this because it really is, I'd say, it counteracts, I'd say, my mind tendency, which is to be here then in a way. If I'm in Paris, I'm thinking of going to Barcelona, or I'm always like three steps ahead of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that I realized that was always my tendencies. I'd always be jumping ahead, planning. In fact, mm-hmm. when I've been on long meditation retreats, I get a real kick out of myself because I could be sitting in the most austere meditation room at a retreat far away in the woods, and I will be thinking about what I am going to do on break. But what's great is I catch myself doing that. Mm-hmm. So it's really also a way to know yourself mm-hmm. and to know the tricks that your mind mm-hmm. plays on you.
When we're not in the present moment, we are in the past, regretting, guilting ourselves about things we shouldn't have done, or in the future when we're worrying and planning and anticipating. And those two states of mind are not the present moment. And we can, through training, learn to let go of those and just accept them as moments in time and allow ourselves to quiet down so we might experience the quiet of our mind rather than the busyness of our mind.
When John Kabat-Zinn said, mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way on purpose. And so he went on to really talk about the purposefulness of it. Mindfulness involves paying attention on purpose. What does that mean? You're making a conscious choice. It's a conscious direction of where our awareness is going to go. In order to be mindful, I have to be purposefully choosing what I am paying attention to, not just vaguely or habitually aware. So knowing you are eating is not the same thing as eating mindfully. And I find, and Pat and I will talk later about how one trains one's mind, literally one's neurons and synapses, to pay attention. There's actually a part of the brain that is like the attentional part of the brain, that when you learn to pay attention, it's the opposite of attention deficit. When you learn to, in fact, these practices are excellent for people with attention deficit problems. But when you learn to pay attention, what does that mean in real life? Well, to me, it means much less worry. Because what I'll do is a thought will come in, and what's worry about? Worries about the future, just like you were saying. You know, you're worried about something that could happen. And then I ask myself, do I know it's going to happen? And my answer is, don't know. And it's always don't know, because you really never know the future. You could think it's likely the stock market will crash or that your kid will end up in jail, but you really don't know. And then choosing over and over again to move away from that worry-ward pattern and to come back to today. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh has a nice way. He's a Vietnamese monk who, but I think Martin Luther King nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize. He never got it. But he talks about watering the seeds of in your store consciousness. And this is the same thing. It's really watering your synapses.
The idea of purposeful, I think that's an important concept that I'd like to stay with for just a minute. We might daydream, we might stare out the window, or we might contemplate certain ideas, which has a purpose. But mindfulness training means that we are dedicating time and space to a kind of thinking about ourselves, experiencing ourselves and experiencing our thinking. And the purposefulness, I think, is a very important piece. It's not something you might, maybe I'll do it tomorrow, maybe I'll do it next week. If you want to experience the benefits, there is a dedication, if you will, that's somewhat required. I don't want to get too, police-like about it, but like any skill, the more you do it, the quicker you'll learn it and the better you'll be at it. So on purpose, I think, is an important piece, and I'm glad you brought it up.
And you also talk about discipline, because what Pat and I are really talking about is a meditation practice, and we'll describe that in a moment. But what you're doing to train your mind so that when you're not doing formal meditation practice, that your attentional muscle is really strong and you can bring it back even in dire times, because that's when you want it, when you're really beset and you can bring yourself back to the present. It reduces suffering.
I think that's why many people might be interested in mindfulness or meditation, is that they are experiencing things in their world, their emotional life, that are painful. And they're interested, possibly, in the, why is this happening to me? How is this happening? When is this happening? And mindfulness training allows us to experience the how, when, why of our mind. So wanting to ease the pain of your life, your emotional life, your physical life, is a really good reason to be interested in mindfulness, don't you think?
You mean wanting to experience the suffering?
To understand the suffering.
Yeah.
To be
and to reduce it. I mean, it's not just looking. It's not just looking at a bad car accident over and over again.
It doesn't happen very quickly. It can for some people, but it doesn't happen in a week, let's say, a week of mindfulness training.
No. Oh, no. It's an ongoing process. I sort of compare it to strength training.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Because with strength training, if I do it really religiously for a year, work out at the gym, no matter what my body type is, I'm going to have more muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I stop it for years, it's going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
If I only go once a week, I only get once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Benefit. If I go every day, which you're not supposed to do, you're only supposed to do it every other day, but not with meditation. So whatever I put into it is what I get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially, I may teach clients techniques like the don't know technique.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't expect them to have a daily meditation practice, but I know darn well that technique is going to work a whole lot better, especially in hard times,
mm-hmm.
if they have trained their attentional muscle,
mm-hmm.
which is actually in their brain. Let me continue for mm-hmm. a moment to give an example of mindfulness with off the cushion, as we say, not when you're meditating. So we'll continue with the example of eating. When we're purposely aware of eating, this is purpose again, we're on purpose, we are consciously being aware of the process of eating. We're deliberately noticing the sensations and our responses to those sensations. We're noticing the mind wandering, and when it does wander, we purposefully bring our attention back to what we're eating. Have you ever done the raisin exercise with clients?
Mm.
This is one that Kabat-Zinn uses. Mm. And you take a raisin, and you have your client look at the raisin and say, okay, where did this come from? What are the causes and conditions of this raisin? So you get to know your raisin and you look at it and you say, it took the sun and the earth nutrients and all the people who brought the raisin to me, including the farmers and the packers and the truck drivers and the stockers and the woman at the checkout line and the people who made the boxes. And then I have them put it in their mouth, but don't chew it, one raisin. And just roll it around, and very quietly we talk about, okay, well, you know, just feel it with all your senses. Taste, can't smell it probably. And then just take a long time. And usually it takes so long that the digestive juice is in the mouth, you don't have to chew it, and it just kind of disappears. But that's a very... Kabat-Zinn, in all his mindfulness-based stress reduction programs, does the raisin exercise. When we're eating unmindfully, we may technically be aware of what we're doing. We know we're eating, but we're probably thinking about 101 things at the same time.
Or reading or watching television. Or
all the above. Right. The purposefulness is a very important part of mindfulness, having the purpose of staying with our experience, whether it's the breath or a particular emotion. And Kabat-Zinn's work, MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, does very interesting things with pain, because what's interesting is you look at the pain. Because when you fight the pain, what happens? You tense up and you feel more pain. And MBSR is now pretty much the gold standard in many excellent hospitals for alternatives to pain medication or in addition to pain medication. In Seattle, Virginia Mason has a program, Swedish has a program, and then name any major university hospital, Stanford, etc. So it's really, really the way to go now for pain. So let me just... let our audience know that I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and in the studio with me is Pat White, a Juno counselor. And what we're talking about today is our mindfulness practices that promote well-being and reduce stress. And you can call in, and during the show, we're live, and you can call in. And we will get you either on the air or you can dictate the question to our operator and be perfectly anonymous, and we will never use your name. So just call in at 463-6425 with any questions or comments you have about this. We'd really appreciate it. Pat, could you give me some examples of what techniques you might teach a client?
Well, I excuse me. I think the idea of becoming friendly with one's feelings is how I like to phrase it. Oftentimes, people will come into my office really confused and uncertain about not only what they're feeling, but what to do with their feelings. So I teach them how to keep track of their feelings at first. Keep a scorecard. No reason why one's feeling it or the circumstances that might have been there to create the feeling or the reaction that creates the feeling. So they just keep a little scorecard. That awareness of the variety of and the feelings I give them are the basic ones: mad, sad, glad, afraid, and lonely. And they keep track. So they come back after a couple of weeks and they become aware of emotion, which is the beginnings of mindfulness. Let me take stock of what I actually feel during a day. Not why or when or how, but just the emotion. And sometimes people are a little uncertain about what an emotion feels like in the body, so we do that kind of talk and training about that. So that's the first step. And if they seem interested in that, then I begin to teach them breathing as a way to calm some of the emotions that they are uncomfortable with. Sometimes people are uncomfortable with sad and mad. And that's when we start using the breath to slow the mind down and to use the awareness from the scorecard to sitting comfortably and quietly with those emotions that will inevitably arise. So that's one way I do that. Some people are not. It's the people who are interested, of course, in it that I'm doing this with. Yeah.
It's one technique doesn't fit all people, and
right.
And you know, it depends on what they're coming in with. I think especially I do a lot of couple counseling, and I work with a lot of anger, people who are very, very angry at their partner, and they just think they're angry because he or she did a certain thing, and your technique would be extremely appropriate because what I say is anger is a secondary emotion. There's always something under anger. Mm-hmm. And with your technique, they could really look and see, is it sad? Well, we know it's mad.
Mm-hmm.
It's not glad. And really take a look. Is it fear? Often it's fear.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's fear they're going to leave them, fear things won't be right. And so anyways, your technique would work well.
So then after they, people might get more interested and more comfortable with this and be a little bit excited about these emotions, then I teach them the letting go of them, letting the emotion come into their mind as it naturally and normally does, and to let it go in that non-judgmental, neutral kind of way. And we create images, big leaves that you might put the emotion on and let it float down a stream. Throw it out the window, let the wind take it, bag him up and throw him over the bridge into the channel. You know, all kinds of different ways to let go. And using an image to let that, because that helps people at first to use their imaginations.
Do you ever people say, I don't want to let them go? I grew up in a family where, let's say they say this, you know, maybe they I grew up in a family where I had always stuffed my emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So they think like emotions are important. You know, if you feel it, say it.
Mm-hmm.
How would you respond to somebody like that?
Well, I would ask them if there's any of those emotions that they say, but they're not comfortable with, or they wish they didn't have them as much, as often. So I'd get the ones that they were willing to let go of. And we start there.
Yeah, and one thing I talk about is emotions or feelings. Emotions are feelings, they're not facts. And to if we all look and we could see that emotions change, mm-hmm. that spouse that you're so angry with and whose foibles really irritate you, mm-hmm. the next day could just be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I see them as like floating in the sky like clouds, because particularly in our culture, we give such solidity to emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. When people get to that awareness that they're changing, I know that that's progress, if you will, because then I can point out that if they change, you know that they're going to come back and they'll go away again,
mm-hmm.
and they'll come back and they'll go away, even the good ones. So if we are enjoying ourselves, if we're feeling wonderfully connected to people, we're enjoying our meal or whatever it is, we know that it's going to change. And that certainty of change at a certain level of awareness is really helpful to people.
Right, right.
It gives them confidence. It gave me confidence. It gives them confidence.
This too shall pass.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
It always changes.
Right.
Well, I think this would be a great moment to take a breather and play a song that I think should be part of our repertoire about money can't buy you happiness or love. Go for it. Okay, are we back on? We almost had a different song, but we'll wait for that. And, you know, there's actual proof that money can't buy you happiness. I don't know, Pat, if you're familiar with these really big longitudinal studies where they're tracking people's level of contentment according to, you know, they're taking a look at how it relates to income. And the deal is... Once you've achieved lower middle class status, which is you have a job, a car, and a house, okay, basically you've got your enough money for food, that increased wealth brings you no more happiness. Now, I know that's counterintuitive, but here's an even more counterintuitive study. It's about vacations. And we all assume that you're happier on vacations, right? I mean, we pay a lot of money. It's... Getting out of Juneau costs an arm and a leg, and we want to go to Hawaii and we're on vacations. So some researchers gave people little clickers and that would go off. They were programmed to go beep at random times during the day, and they were to click in their level of happiness or level of contentment. And they carried these for like a year, on vacation, off vacation. Some were retired, some were working. Guess what? You can guess. No difference on vacation or whether you're working or doing your normal, you're at home and you're working. And if you think about it, the stress that can come from being on vacation, you know, the bad weather, you've saved up all your money and the bad weather in Hawaii or Disneyland is 110 in the shade and the kids are screaming and your daughter has the flu. And you just expect more out of a vacation. So we can cut the vacations, which is very good news because it's really expensive to get out of Juneau, and just stay home. These are the homecations, I guess. Anyways, what we're thinking of is giving you an idea of what we're talking about when we say meditation.
Or mindfulness practices.
Yeah.
Mindfulness training. Right?
Yeah. Pat mentioned, you know, it takes discipline, it takes purpose. So this gives you the idea. A person who's going to meditate or has a meditation practice, they sit in an upright posture. They could be either on a chair or sitting cross-legged on the floor. There could be even other postures. And what they do is they attempt to maintain attention on a particular focus. Most likely, it will be the physical sensations of their own breathing. Whenever attention wanders from the breath to the inevitable thoughts and feelings that arise, the person will simply take notice of them and then let them go as they turn their attention back to their breathing. And by the breathing, you can even notice the very subtle sensation of the air going across the hairs as you inhale on the upper lip. And so this process is repeated each time that the attention wavers. So when your mind goes elsewhere, you bring it back to your breathing. Elsewhere, you bring it back to your breathing. Non-judgmentally. It could be thoughts. It could be an itch. It could be a noise that occurred in the room. Anything outside yourself. Or in your head. So a sitting meditation is practiced. There's an emphasis on simply taking notice of whatever the mind, whenever the mind happens to wander, and accepting each object. Now, by object, it could be any stimulus that could grab your attention, including a sensation, thoughts or feelings, sounds, smells.
So, excuse me, so many people try this technique, and it's the time-honored technique, and they say, I have to come back to my breath so much, I must be doing it wrong. And I say, no, you're doing it absolutely right. That every time you're aware that you've lost your focus of concentration, you come back. That's what's supposed to happen. Even if you're doing it 100 times in 10 minutes, that's what you're supposed to be doing, because you're breaking the other mind, if you will, the mind of discursive thought.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really important point, that the more you do it, the better it is.
And kind of, so somebody could think, oh, my mind was monkey mind all day. Mm-hmm. During my time, whether it's 10 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour, you could get upset because it's wandering all over. And as Pat is saying, good job. Mm-hmm. You just keep that intention mm-hmm. of bringing it back. Now, any meditator knows that there are times when you're feeling very naughty. And by naughty, I mean, and I'll just speak for myself. I'm a planner, right? I told you about that. So then I'll be sitting there meditating, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, let's see, what am I going to do this weekend? And then I catch myself, but I really want to finish that thought. So every once in a while I'll finish it, and then I'll go, no, can't do that, and bring my attention back. But what Pat is saying is, the more you bring it back, the more you're working out, man. You're working out that attentional muscle, just like you were doing weight training. So there's an emphasis on simply taking notice of whatever the mind happens, whenever it happens to wander, accepting all the all the interruptions, or not interruptions, but all the thoughts or sounds, without making judgments, no judgments, not elaborating on what it means. You don't need to act on it. And then you have meditation, but not meditation, but mindfulness practice, when you're not sitting on the cushion.
Wait. There's also the idea of being kind to yourself. If you feel like you're not doing it right, or it's taking a long time, or I have all these thoughts, and we are harsh with ourselves, I think a very important point here is non-judgmental, but also kind.
Yeah.
I think it was Jack Kornfield or Joseph Goldstein, I can't remember who said this, but he said, mind training is like training a puppy. That you have to be kind and gentle to that puppy and redirect the puppy to the behavior that you want. And your mind is the same way. You have to be kind and gentle and redirect your mind to where you want it to go.
Well, the idea of like Zen boot camp, okay, would totally contradict this. The inspiration has to come within, where you are going to have yourself sit. The non-judgmental part of it would be you're not judging yourself. So there's that intricate, that sort of subtle balance between discipline, saying, I want to do this every day, and too much pressure on yourself. Mm-hmm. And part of training and part of meditation training, ideally you want to have a meditation teacher to help you through those moments. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some mindfulness practices that one can do when one is not formally meditating. Do you have some thoughts on that? Have you ever had clients work on that?
Well, I propose those to clients when they're sort of ready for that. I do this myself, and I can just describe what I do for myself. I at this point in my life, I am using my shoes as a mindfulness practice. And when I take my shoes off, it's coming into the house or wherever, I am focusing my mind on placing my shoes evenly and placing them on the floor in a particular way, so that I'm putting all my attention to taking off my shoes and placing them on the floor. And that's very helpful because we take my shoes off a lot, and it brings me back to the present moment, so that I am not thinking about anything else but putting my shoes where they're nicely spaced and gently down on the floor. I have used mindfulness practice in my business when I would go in from my counseling room to my waiting room, and I would take the doorknob and I would, for a moment, take a breath and clear my mind and be ready for the next person. Did that for a year or so. I take these things on in year intervals. It's a long time to figure it out.
So what you're talking about is choosing something you do every day, touching the doorknob, mm-hmm. crossing the threshold of a door. What was the other one you said?
Placing my shoes.
Yeah, placing mm-hmm. your shoes. Mm-hmm. Another one that has... I've suggested clients use, and I've done myself, is whenever the phone rings.
Mm. And what do you do?
Wait for it to ring at least one time. Mm-hmm. Just pause, mm-hmm. and then pick it up. Mm-hmm. And I learned that from attending a Thich Nhat Hanh retreat, because at Plum Village in France, they use the phone as a mindfulness mm-hmm. bell. Mm-hmm. And another thing one learns when one attends retreats is mindful eating. Mm-hmm. Because at Thich Nhat Hanh retreats, they love the bell. It's a Vietnamese tradition to use the mindfulness bell. And meals are eaten in silence. And periodically during the meal, a bell will ring. And you stop. You just remember the game Statue Maker?
Mm-hmm.
Like you freeze. Mm-hmm. So you just stop.
And notice where your mind is.
And you notice what you're thinking. You notice what the food tastes mm-hmm. like if it's in your mouth. Mm-hmm. You kind of stop if you're just about to have some food. You just pay attention mm-hmm. briefly and then move on. Now, mindfulness practices have been incorporated into treatment for eating disorders. particularly compulsive overeating.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah, and some of the best minds in the field are really mindfulness practices around eating and compulsive overeating are now standard operating procedure. And here's what's interesting. Weight Watchers, National Weight Watchers, is now including, in addition to counting points or whatever they do, a scale where you pay attention when you're eating to your fullness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mindful mm-hmm. attention to how full you are.
Mm-hmm.
Because people who engage in what are called emotional eating or compulsive overeating will just eat.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they've said this, but when I work with compulsive overeaters, they are not to do anything else while they are eating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they can eat in company with others, but no TV, no mm-hmm. book, no nothing,
mm-hmm.
because then you're off automatic pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You
exactly.
are,
yeah.
you're totally aware.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really talking about choosing something as simple as brushing your teeth. Brushing your teeth can be a mindfulness practice.
Mm-hmm. When you're brushing your teeth, brush your teeth.
When you make tea. And in the Kabat-Zinn 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction program, the standard procedure is to assign clients, or assign participants every week a different mindfulness practice,
mm-hmm.
brushing teeth,
mm-hmm.
eating, paying attention to positive emotions, and they
mm-hmm.
keep a log, very
mm-hmm.
much like yours,
mm-hmm.
paying attention the next week to negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping a log,
mm-hmm.
and just becoming aware. And in the mindfulness-based stress reduction program, people are learning to meditate, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
mm-hmm.
a part of it. And it's real important to know, I think, that how much of this, these mindfulness practices in the psychotherapeutic context are empirically substantiated.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, literally hundreds and hundreds of studies
mm-hmm.
Have been conducted on different mindfulness practices and their impact.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably one of the most evidence-based, some of the most evidence-based techniques that we have
mm-hmm.
in our toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you an example with mindfulness-based stress reduction. Probably the most famous neuroscientist in the field of mindfulness and cognition is a guy named Richard Davidson from the University of Wisconsin. And I'll actually be attending a conference with him in January. I'm very, very delighted. And anyways, he got very interested because he noticed that monks seem, when he was traveling in Asia, he noticed that monks tended to be very calm. And he really wanted to see what their brains were like. So he brought a bunch of, we'll call them professional meditators, over to the States and wired them up to what then was a fairly new instrument. It was the functional MRI. We all know what an MRI is, but the functional MRI is a machine that actually takes moving pictures, videos of what your brain does, and rather than slices or photos in time. And it really allows neuroscientists to see exactly where the brain reacts when you do something. And so he'd have these monks go in the functional MRI and he'd take a look at their brain. Now, neuroscientists already knew that the emotions tend to reside are in the prefrontal lobe. The left prefrontal is where positive emotions reside and the right prefrontal is where negative emotions reside. Pretty slick pattern there. And so he was taking a look at them, and he also had baseline data of your average person or your average American and what their balance is, because the way it works is there's actually a normal curve. Most of us, a normal bell-shaped curve, I should say, most of us reside kind of 50-50 in the middle, you know, some mm-hmm. positive, some negative kind of in there. And if you tend to have a more melancholy temperament, you're going to be more on the right. And if you tend to have a more perky temperament, you're going to be more on the left. Well, what do you think happened to their graph? They were total outliers on the left.
Mm-hmm.
Outliers, meaning these are people who you just don't see this in normal life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the question is, are super happy people attracted to be in monasteries? Well, we know that's not the case, because actually a lot of monasteries in the East are orphanages where kids get left and then they're trained as monks. So they're not exactly chosen out of prep schools, okay, or happiness academies. But they want to know this. So what Davidson did, and this is a super famous study. It occurred around 10 years ago. You've even seen results from it in Time magazine cover. National Geographic, one issue, had a picture of a monk all wired up. And so what they wanted to do was, at the time, John Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness-based stress reduction was like the package deal. This was a great intervention that you could replicate over and over again. So Davidson actually had Kabat-Zinn. He wanted him come to Madison, and they used tech firms, and they got volunteers from tech firms, everything from janitor to the CEO, who volunteered to take this 8-week program. So they did pre and post. They took a look at their brains before, and they took a look at their brains afterwards. And they also gave them a flu shot, which is important because they're going to see what happens to their immune system. Mm-hmm. And the results are that people shifted significantly to the left. And they stayed to the left if they kept up their meditation practice. And they responded much more quickly to the flu shot. So their immune system was enhanced. Mm-hmm. Was enhanced. And there's just been, like I said, hundreds. I mean, there's Harvard, Stanford, Wisconsin, Michigan. I'm just thinking of the schools that have even centers for studying the impact of mindfulness on mood, on health, for depression.
Pain reduction, as you mentioned
earlier. Oh, yeah, pain reduction. Okay. Psoriasis. Psoriasis. I mean,
hypertension, headaches, anxiety.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it sounds like the cure-all, but let me use one wonderful intervention. It's mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And Pat's familiar with it. I'm familiar with it. It combines training and mindfulness meditation with cognitive therapy. Large, large, controlled, randomized controlled studies show significantly reduced the state of relapse in recurrent major depression. And other researchers have studied the integration of mindfulness approaches into the treatment of anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance abuse. Marlett from University of Washington, and as I mentioned, eating disorders. So being aware of your mind is a big help.
Mm-hmm. If we go back to what we're actually doing when we're practicing mindfulness or when we're meditating, if we are becoming more aware of our thought patterns and our emotional patterns without judging them or wondering why or how come, we become more neutral in response, we become less reactive, and then all of the accompanying body sensations when we're less reactive. But what I really want to get to is the idea that what will our minds be like if we have less thoughts or less feelings? What might we experience? Do we experience a quiet? Do we experience a spaciousness? Somebody once said that meditating is, our thoughts in meditation are like a train car, many cars coupled together, moving down the track, and that meditation allows us to be in between the cars, and we might experience the space between our thoughts and feelings. And if that were the case, what's that like? And what's the benefit of that, or what then in that space? Uh-huh. And what do you think about that?
Well, I think that space is the possibility of what might be called pure awareness. Mm-hmm. And I think I've seen pure awareness, but not in myself. Mm-hmm. But my husband and I lived in Asia for many years, including Nepal, and we've met Tibetan monks who have come to Juneau over the mm-hmm. 28 years we've lived here and visited us on occasion. And some of them in the old days were fresh out of Nepal. Remember, they couldn't come from Tibet, so they would be part of the Tibetan diaspora, but the first time in the West. And I remember some monks coming in and looking at our house and looking around and just pure awareness, like just taking in everything. And it was like with child mind, mm-hmm. like
just
seeing it for the first thing.
Yeah, experiencing it.
Totally yeah. experiencing it. Mm-hmm. Kind of like with a wow. Mm-hmm. Experiencing it. Looking out the window. Oh. Mm-hmm. And somebody told me a story the other day about their grandchild who was watching football on TV for the first time. And the little kid, like 2-3 years old, and they're watching it with their mouth, their jaws dropped, because they've never seen anybody pushing other people around. Now, they're probably a little shocked, but it was like, wow, mommy, look, because they had never seen football before. It was the first time.
Mm-hmm. So when we're training our minds, we might look at a sunset and feel the experience of the beauty and say, isn't that beautiful? But we don't hang on to, I wish it would last forever. How come sunsets aren't always like this? I'm getting cold. I want to go in. We allow ourselves to experience it fully as we possibly can, without all the peripherals. So, So I imagine the monks were experiencing the beauty of the view from your home, which is quite lovely, and maybe even saying that, isn't this a lovely place? But not clinging. I want to live here. Well, I don't want to go home. You know, that's not happening.
No.
And
yeah.
That's mindfulness is the pure experience.
Yeah. Pure experience and when you talk about not clinging, it has me think about some of the philosophical implications of what can happen when you have trained the mind to be more aware. Mm-hmm. Because it goes deeper and deeper the more you practice. Mm-hmm. And I think as a result of mindfulness practice, there's greater acceptance of our own reality. Mm-hmm. And just like you're saying, the monks might look out and say, oh, this is beautiful. Mm-hmm. But they're not saying, oh, darn it, now I have to go back to Nepal mm-hmm. with all the pollution. Mm-hmm. It's just, this is beautiful. Because otherwise, if they're clinging to wanting to have it forever, to stay forever, to be theirs, what do they get? They get mm-hmm. suffering.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And an aspect of that, the greater acceptance of what is, and the Dalai Lama has a quote that goes something like, the greater the distance between the way things are and the way that we want them to be is the measure of unhappiness. And being mindful is learning to be present with what is. So even if you're on vacation in Hawaii and a tropical storm comes in, you go, wow, this is what is now. I mean, it's really dealing with one thing I did. Well, I had to face all the time when I first moved here. I was flying back and forth to Seattle for a while as I was moving here. And darn it, I was always getting in snowstorms and you couldn't land in Juneau. I would turn around and go back to Ketchikan. Okay, and I'm going, oh my gosh, where am I going? You know, this is scary. You get in Ketchikan, you have to take the ferry across. Mm-hmm. And then in those days, they hadn't built that big fancy hotel, and there was only a couple of hotels, and there weren't enough rooms for everybody, because everybody was grounded in Ketchikan. And I had already started my meditation practice, so it would almost be like I was taking my head and going on purpose. Okay, kiddo, you're here now. And I remember one time where I nudged a woman next to me and I said, want to share a room? And she turned out to be a Juneau museum director. This is a long time ago. And the sky cleared, but of course we couldn't get on another plane the next day because everything was booked. The sky cleared and she said, let me take you around Ketchikan and I'll show you all the museums. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, mm-hmm. I could have just ruined this whole thing by being very upset that I wasn't getting it. I was attached to what I expected to happen. Mm-hmm. So I trained myself a little bit to be there now. And so the less grasping, the less suffering, mm-hmm. the greater acceptance, mm-hmm. and being in the moment is just mm-hmm. saying, this is what is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. In that, too, is the idea of expectation. If we are grasping at something, we may have an expectation that says, I want it, I deserve it. If I don't get it, I'm going to be miserable. So I think mindfulness training allows us to become much more aware of our thinking pattern, as we've said, but in that is the detail of our anticipations, our expectations. And with that awareness, we can act more responsibly. Well, that's a little bit too tough, but that we can act rather than react. I'll say it that way.
Yeah.
And which gives us greater happiness, I believe.
Yeah. To consciously act, because what we're mm-hmm. learning is to pay attention to what is.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not dealing with confused emotions at mm-hmm. the time. I mean, or we're aware that they're confused
mm-hmm.
emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we can act more skillfully.
Mm-hmm. Right. What skillfully?
Oh, I use that word a lot in therapy,
mm-hmm.
and because I prefer it. It's not judgmental. It's not saying you're acting smart or you're acting dumb. I'm not putting a moral value. Like if I'm working, let's say, with parents who scream at their children, I say, is that a skillful thing to do? Rather than, you know, that's wrong. You shouldn't scream at your children.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very research oriented, and I say, well, a lot of people have looked at that question, yelling at your kids, screaming at them. Let's see what happens. And this is what I know that happens. You know, they get scared and they feel bad, and they lose their respect for you,
mm-hmm.
and they probably will role model you and scream at their kids or scream at their girlfriend or scream at their teacher or scream at somebody, and it seems to get everybody in a whole lot of trouble, and it really is bad vibes in the house. So it's not skillful, because what you really want, and that's how I use it, what you really want, skillful is getting what you think, doing something that the long-term outcome is really what you're
mm-hmm.
you're
about,
seeking,
right,
is what
right.
you're thinking about.
Right.
Does that make sense to you? How
yeah,
would you
oh,
use
yeah.
it?
I in the case of screaming at children, at your children, I like to talk about what behavior do you want back from your children you need to give to them,
mm-hmm.
that you're going to get back what you give them, so be skillful about what you give them.
Yeah.
And think carefully about
right.
how. And if you're so harried or rushed or impatient or angry, well, let's deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Another aspect, I think, philosophical aspect of what we learned with training our mind to be really aware is the truth of impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the biggest causes of suffering is that things change. Everything changes. Nothing stays the same. And impermanence, to really grasp impermanence and understand that, I think with aging, okay, Pat and I happen to be aging, just in case you didn't know that. Of course, everybody's aging, but we're really aging. And I have a favorite thing I say to myself as I am aging and get creaky and lose a tooth and do all sorts of things that I never thought would happen to me. And I go right on schedule,
mm-hmm.
because I'm so now working on being aware of, one, the inevitability of my mortality, of dying, the inevitability of old age and sickness,
mm-hmm.
and to be aware of that, it's a fact, really reduces the suffering we experience by all the changes that occur that we don't want,
mm-hmm.
because it all fits in with the lack of clinging,
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm. I the impermanent nature of things applies also to the good stuff. And we have to allow ourselves to know that the good stuff's going to go away too.
And that's really good to end
It'll
on the
back.
Good stuff.
The good stuff will
well,
come back.
Well,
is it time?
It's almost time, and we're going to wind up. We've got a minute. And so I like ending on the idea of the good stuff, but that is clinging too, because it comes and goes, and nothing stays the same. But Pat, I want to thank you. Pat mm-hmm. White, wonderful Juno therapist.
Thank you.
She hasn't been here as long as I have, but that's okay. And thank you for being here tonight. And I would like to thank our technical support, John and Dolly Kramers, who so beautifully multitask throughout this show. I'll see you in October.
Thank you, Elaine.
Bye.